the cute little gadget. Right. Today is July 17th, 2007. My name is Mary Owen. I am the interviewer, and I am here with Doris Merritt. Is it all right to take this interview and deposit it in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives?
It is perfectly all right to record it and to deposit it in the IUPUI Special Archives.
Thank you. Tell me a little bit about your early life and how you decided to get into medicine.
We may need that 11 hours. Suffice to say that when I was a senior in college and looking for something to do when I graduated, this was in 1944, and I was recruited by a Navy recruiter to go to officers' candidate school. After 2.5 years doing what was essentially secretarial work, and we had to be officers because it was top secret material, and the Navy regs say only officers can use top secret material, I realized that I was going to be out of the Navy someday, since I was not electing to stay in. I, at that time, had no intention of being married, and with a background in English literature and philosophy, I wasn't exactly equipped for very much, except perhaps in those days, teaching secretarial work, and some sales, I think. That didn't sound very exciting. I had a roommate who had been pre-med, and in trying to talk her into going back to school, I talked myself into the idea of going into medicine. When I checked with the catalogs, it was very clear that a background in English literature and philosophy had not equipped me with enough science. And I had to go back to, in those days we were in Washington, D.C., I went back to the chairman of the admissions committee and with complete naivete told him I wanted to go to medical school. He assured me a lot of people did. In the course of the interview, I asked him if it was really necessary if I went back and got all that science. Poor man. You know, I was only 23 at the time, and I looked about 12, and I had no idea what I was getting into. He was very patient with me, and he assured me that I did need all that science. In the course of all this, he asked me if I realized how many women were admitted to medical school. And I said I realized it wasn't many, and he said, well, at the maximum we take 3. Mm-hmm. And I heaved a great sigh of relief because it never occurred to me I wouldn't be one of the 3, which must have sort of floored him too. However, he finally said, well, go and take some prerequisites and come back and see me in 6 months. I think he thought he was well rid of me, but I turned up on his doorstep in 6 months with an A, a B, and a C. An A in zoology, a B in chemistry, and a C in physics, which I thought should have knocked me out, but it didn't. Long story short, I was admitted, and 4 years later, I graduated with another woman out of 80-some-odd boys. That's how I got into medicine.
Wow. So, being one of the only women in the program, did you face any difficulties or different situations than the men?
We faced a lot of teasing, but you know, it was never nasty teasing, or I never felt it was nasty teasing. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty laid back anyway, and I had a good time. And not only were we not treated in a nasty fashion, we were a little bit protected because a lot of the clinical sequences we had to take were in pretty nasty parts of the city. And I can tell you, and I even recognized it at the time, that we were always accompanied by one of our classmates. Mm-hmm. They had just decided that we were not going to go alone. And I have nothing but very happy memories of medical school, frankly. Hard work, good memories.
That's wonderful. I read in a little biography of you that you originally planned to be a pediatrician.
Yes, when the first 2 years of medical school were all book learning, so to speak, and lab stuff. Mm-hmm. And my first rotation on a clinical ward turned out to be in the geriatric ward of old men. Now, you have to understand we're talking about 50-odd years ago. And the kind of patient that was represented in a charity hospital were old syphilitics, old cirrhotics, old tuberculars. And I was just absolutely flummoxed. It had never occurred to me that doctors had to take care of those people. I told you I was naive. And I remember the first year, the first day after I went off that ward, I went home and I thought, dear Lord, I spent 6 years of my life, you know, trying to do this. Fortunately, my next rotation was pediatrics. And it was an excellent ward, an excellent experience, and I thought, well, at least I can do this. And I persevered in that all the way through boards.
Okay. And so then at what point did you completed a residency, and then what did you do after that?
Internship and 4 years of residency.
Okay.
At the end of the internship year, I married one of my classmates and spent a year in Washington where he had to finish his first year of residency and I did a fellowship. Then we both went back to Duke University for 3 years. At the end of that period of time, we're now talking 5 years out of medical school, I had my first baby. And Don decided he wanted to go to the National Institutes of Health, which was the place to go at that time to get research training. And I decided I would stay home and be a mother. I was completing a chapter in a book on chronic diseases in children, and the first 2 months at home I was busy with this creature and my writing, and things were fine. As soon as that was done, I realized that I was never going to make it as a stay-at-home mother, and went to NIH and said I would like a job, and they said we'd love to have you in the Heart Institute, but next year, because medical appointments are July to July, we're filled up now, it's September, we have no opening. Why don't you go to the Division of Research Grants? You've had some administrative experience, and they need people to run their review committees. Why not? And that was the end of any practice for me. I just loved it.
Wonderful. So once you started at National Institute of Health, what type of position were you in?
It was called an executive secretary. And you ran, literally, you were responsible for the nuts and bolts of running a, what they called a study section, still call them study sections, of 12 to 15 people who were the absolute top notch in the country. When I tell you that I had a Nobel laureate on my committee, you understand what I'm talking about. It was André Clonand, and he chaired that committee. And you met three times a year, reviewed the applications that were sent in, were responsible for getting the appropriate information, for taking your committee members on trips, and then presenting the findings of the committee, writing them up, and presenting the findings to the National Council. And there at that time must have been, Lord knows, there are about 20 now, but at the time there were 12 councils. And the one that cardiovascular served primarily was heart, lung, and blood. Then it was just heart. Everything changed. So that's what I did with my time, and just dearly loved it.
Wonderful. And then at what point did you leave there to come to Indiana University?
Back at Indiana University, the gentleman who was chairman of the Department of Medicine had been a professor at Duke, and he knew both me and my husband. He was also, his name was John Hickam, and he was also very much aware that the future of research in medical schools was going to be dependent on NIH funding. So he recruited Don to be a member of his faculty, and I don't know what sort of blackmail he held the dean of the School of Medicine to, but he finally got him to recruit me to be director of grants and contracts. So, and an assistant professor of pediatrics, because unless you keep the professional titles in a medical school and nobody pays attention to you. That's quite liberal.
Was that the director of grants, was that something that was unusual for a woman to have? Or?
It was probably the second one in the country.
Okay.
The only other one I knew at the time was a man named Henry Meadows at Harvard who had developed that position. So it was brand new, wide open, and after a year they made me assistant dean at that time for research in the School of Medicine because they wanted to keep it academic. And when I went there, we had $2 million worth of outside funding, most of which was drug company and private benefactor. Mm-hmm. It just grew exponentially.
So what did you all do in that position?
Try to help people get money and get things done. Try to show them the ins and outs of how to write a good grant. Listen to them. When they got their money, try to help them around the system in the university, which is hideously bureaucratic if you want to do anything. I mean, do I need to tell you? And it was generally helpful. I also never confined myself to the one school because I was there and I could help a dentist, and I help a dentist, help a nurse, it didn't matter. We didn't have IUPUI things.
Okay.
We're just School of Medicine, School of Nursing, School of Dentistry. Allied Health Science, part of dentistry. Actually, it was so long ago, this is 1961, that the dean of the School of Nursing actually reported to the dean of the School of Medicine.
Oh,
it
wow.
was not a freestanding school
okay.
in that sense. So, what else about that time? It was pretty easy. It was fun. And I'll give you more anecdotes than you need to know.
After that, was that the only position you held before you returned to the National Institutes of Health, or did you do other things?
Okay, now we're getting into where you may really need to check dates. Elvis Starr came to the university as president sometime in the early 60s.
Okay.
Van Nies, who was the dean when I was there, when I came, died, and he was replaced by Glenn Irwin. So we now have a campus where the IU Extension Center is what it was called, liberal arts, was downtown someplace. Again, you had to go downtown. Mm-hmm. I knew that, and it was in an office building with a creaky elevator. Purdue had just begun to occupy the Purdue School of Engineering and Technology on 38th Street opposite the fairgrounds. And in and around here, the political climate was such that there was a great deal of agitation in Indianapolis for a separate university in Indianapolis, which struck terror to the hearts of the Purdue and the IU hierarchy. Because there was not enough money to really support both Purdue and IU, and the thought of having a third entity that was going after state funds was not very palatable. As a result of that, they got together and formed IUPUI.
Okay.
Right. When IUPUI was formed, now I have to backtrack a year, when Starr came and looked at how the IU campus, the IU Indianapolis campus was handled. He had three deans then reporting to a vice president reporting to him. He decided it would be better organization to have somebody on the IU Indianapolis campus who is responsible for all three schools, and then that person could report to him. So they created the IU Medical Center. And a gentleman by the name of Penrod was made the first provost. When Penrod came, he brought me out of the School of Medicine into the school, into his office as dean for, I think he's the dean for research and sponsored programs then, good Lord, you know, 50 years ago, it doesn't matter. So at that point, I was officially responsible for all of the schools. and in terms of grants and contracts.
Okay.
And I was the one who had to sign the official submissions to the various granting agencies. I was not allowed to sign my own name. I had to sign Herman B. Wells' name, but that was all right now. And I was still signing Herman B. Wells, even though Starr was president, because all of the grants were made through the IU Foundation, mm-hmm. not through IU University.
Okay.
They were two separate entities. I can tell you why that changed, too, which was entertaining. Okay, so there I was, IU president / Herman B. Wells. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm back to what happened with IUPUI. When the decision to form IUPUI was made, they needed a chancellor, and they had a search committee for a chancellor. Most of us thought it might be Penrod, because he was the naturalist mm-hmm. provost. Well, he had his own problems with some of the deans, mm-hmm. and the net result was that the first provost, the first chancellor then was Herman Wells.
Okay.
The first chancellor was Maynard Hine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Maynard asked me then to work for him mm-hmm. as dean for research and sponsored programs.
Okay.
So I was then associate professor in medicine. I still sat on the medical school executive committee because mm-hmm. they didn't want me to go away. And I was then responsible officially for the IUPUI research and sponsored programs office.
Okay.
And that's where that started. Mm-hmm. Again, dates, I'd have to look at a CV, which is, you know, endless. Would it help you to have a copy of one?
That'd be wonderful.
Well, when you mm-hmm. leave here, remind
yes.
me and I'll make you one.
Mm-hmm. So then you returned to the National
okay.
Institutes of Health, or what happened with
let's
that?
See. You'd have to get dates for me. That went on. Mm-hmm. The office moved from... the office moved from... the old student union, mm-hmm. the Curly's Cleaners. Have you heard about Curly's Cleaners?
No.
All right. Curly's Cleaners was indeed Curly's Cleaners, and it was in a little triangle of land, which is mm-hmm. now just land, on the corner of Michigan, on the south side of Michigan, opposite the Ball residence. A little tiny mm-hmm. building with a great storefront window. And they bought it out, and the cleaners left, mm-hmm. and the insurance agent left, and the IUPUI administration moved in. And we stayed there for some years until they built the current IUPUI administration building, which I assume eventually they'll vacate. So all that period mm-hmm. of time went on, and IUPUI grew, and the grants grew, and everything mm-hmm. else grew. And we got animal committees and human subjects committees and all the rest of it. So you flip ahead now, and my husband was made chairman of the Department of Medical Genetics, which was only the third in the country at the time. And after 10 mm-hmm. years of that, he said, enough, I'm not mm-hmm. doing this anymore. And I said, well, where do we go? And he said, well, let's try NIH again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what took us back to the NIH.
Okay.
And that was 1978 or so. And I went back to the NIH, where I had known the director. He'd been mm-hmm. on my study section. I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, for heaven's sakes, do something about training. And so my title was Special Assistant to the Director for Training. Mm-hmm. And I was instrumental in establishing the policies and creating them for them. There were 14 institutes out of the director's office.
Okay.
Eventually, I did research resources. And finally, after two more directors came and went, 10 years later, the Congress created the National Center for Nursing Research mm-hmm. and put it at NIH. And then the director was Jim Weingarten, also an old colleague, who said, I want you to direct this the first year. And I said, I can't do that. I'm not a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and this probably shouldn't be quoted, he said, I wouldn't trust a nurse with it. You're going to have to do this. I said, they'll lynch me. I'm an MD. They hate MDs. This is why mm-hmm. they wanted their own center. He said, it's you or no one. And make a long story mm-hmm. short, having the usual doctors, the word distrust of nursing and research, or the heard of nursing and research. I found myself chief nurse researcher in the United States. And it was the biggest eye-opener I ever had. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about nursing research. And I just cannot give high enough accolades to those women who pushed mm-hmm. this thing through nationally, two presidents' vetoes, mm-hmm. and came into my office one day when I'd only been in office about a week. And I just decided how to set this thing up by following what was in the congressional record. They walked into my office and I said, "Am I glad to see you?" They were stunned because they thought I was going to give them the cold shoulder. Mm-hmm. And we worked together and set the thing up and it was beautiful. That was the last year I was at NIH. At that time, my husband developed cancer in the lung and died 7 months later. At which point I knew I didn't want to stay there. And one of the friends from IU was having dinner with me and said, "Hey, Walter Dowley wants you back." And I said, "Well, he hasn't told me so." And he said, "Well, mm-hmm. you know Walter. Why don't you give him a call?" So I mm-hmm. called him and he said, "Come back." And I came back. So that's how mm-hmm. I went away and that's how I came back.
Okay. And what did you do when you came back? Were you in the same position? Or?
No, when I came back, I came... when I came, I have to laugh at this. When I came back, I said to Walter, what do I do? He said, well, what do you want to do? And I, you know, heavens to Betsy, I was 60, what? I was 64 years mm-hmm. old. I just wanted to keep busy. I mm-hmm. said, well, I'll do anything that needs doing. And from then on in, he called me his dean who did what needed to be doing. His dean that got things done. You saw mm-hmm. that. But also when I was coming back, being in the middle of IUPUI developing, everybody did a little everything. And one of the things that I did back in those days was to be part of a focus for business when they wanted to know what was going on in research. They would contact the dean for research, and I got to know a lot of the people who ran, you know, businesses in Indianapolis. Now, that was past. Coming back in 1987, there was a real push on that the universities were not contributing to the business atmosphere and economic development all over the place. And Jerry Bebko, who was vice chancellor, called and said, "Doris, would you be my assistant for economic development when you come back?" And I said, "Right here." "Sure." So I was his assistant for economic development on paper. And then just before coming back, I got a call from Jerry who said, "The president wants you to do it for the university." Mm-hmm. So out of the blue, I am now economic development special assistant to the president. Which one was that? Was it Bullish? Must have been. For economic development. And I thought the nurses were going to have a hard time with me. You should have seen the School of Business. Mm-hmm. They didn't know me. They never heard of me. Economic development was their business. It had nothing to do with this upstart medical person who was coming back as a dean in the School of Medicine. The only thing I produced on that was a little pamphlet which made everybody ecstatic called "At Indiana University, IU means business," and it was nothing but a compendium of what all of the departments and schools did related to economic development in the city. It was the only thing I could do. There was no, I had no budget, no status, no support, so I wrote a brochure. What else do you do? All right. So when I came back then into the School of Medicine, it was to be associate dean for whatever needed to be done. I took over the clinical research center. I took over the animals. I took over all the special committees, and now we had patents and ethics and IRB. Fortunately, I just had to supervise and so forth and so on. Quite mm-hmm. literally, if something needed to be done, I did it. Mm-hmm. Because I was mature, I got shoved in a lot of positions where there were conflicts and controversy, and they needed somebody with a reasonably cool head who was not attached to them to unravel them. And I did that. Did it for nursing, did it for some faculty development things. Just generally had a good time. And finally, I decided that it was time to retire in terms of getting a salary from the campus. So I asked Walter if I could go part-time. He said, you can go whatever time you like. And kept an office and then cut my hours for about 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And took it easy. Then there came the flap with the School of Engineering and Technology, mm-hmm. where Dean Potvin had real confrontation with his faculty. The faculty were very unhappy with him. They gave him a list of, I think, 12, 20 ultimatum things he simply had to do. Mm-hmm. He decided he couldn't do this. He walked out on a Friday. Classes began the following Monday. I happily was on my way to Sanibel for a week when Jerry called me, Jerry Bepko, in the evening. I was in bed, as a matter of fact, I've always been early to sleep, and asked me if I'd act as Dean of the School of Engineering and Technology for a year. And I said, the Purdue people won't like that. And he said, I've spoken to Steve Bering, who said if he can run a university, he can run a school. And he said, and besides that, Doris, the engineers asked for you. Their executive committee knows you. You helped them set up a bio-something program. And they have asked me to ask you. And I said, well, give me a couple of weeks to think about it. I am going on vacation. Mm-hmm. So I came back and did that.
Okay. Now, at what point, you were saying earlier that you had worked with Miriam Langsam?
When did that start back? That started back from the very first beginning of IUPUI. I was always a person who wanted to get grants if grant money was available and put faculty salaries on grants so that they had more money to use faculty salaries. And I saw that the Department of Education had a special program for planning urban campuses. So I asked Mayor Tyne if I could get one. And he said, well, if you can get one, go get one. And I got one with $100,000. And I said to Maynard, hey, you can put part of my salary on this. He said, I will do no such thing. I do not approve of putting faculty salaries on soft money. I have to tell you, by that time, about 40% of the School of Medicine was on soft money. So this was, I said, okay, then, and I needed somebody to help me do this. But campus development, what did I know about urban universities? Nothing. As much as I knew about nursing and later engineering. So I found out that there was this woman in history named Miriam Langsam who was very much interested in campus development. I got hold of Miriam, we hit it off right off the bat. We hired a graduate student and we started to play with what would we do with an urban university if we had our brothers. One of the things we had to do was to get the IU faculty to meet the Purdue faculty, because they were in separate campuses. We organized a series of weekends that the grant paid for at one of the state parks, and we had been some little, whatever they call them now, probably leadership conferences, God knows, but then we were just getting together to know one each other. And we did that, and we developed some schematics for what we thought a campus should look like. One of the things I noticed they actually did without any help from us, when they built the buildings, they had little clusters of places where students could sit in the hallways. I remember when we put that together, we thought that'd be a neat thing to do. There were no buildings then, of course, at that time. It was still extension they were starting to build. We also suggested that the faculty governance should be run by the faculty and it should not be chaired by the chancellor. My chancellor read that, and he said, this report is absolutely worthless. And I said, well, you know, I have to submit it, and I can't change it. This is what we decided to do. So he forwarded it with a note which said, I have absolutely no confidence in the results. Needless to say, when the IUPUI faculty council was formed, if you notice, it is not chaired by the chancellor, it is chaired by the president of the faculty council.
Okay.
So, anyway, that was Miriam and that was me. She then went up through the system in School of Liberal Arts, and she eventually, I think, became something like, I don't know the title, Dean for Students, goodness knows what, but she also handled the exceptional students classes, these are the exceptionally bright students and what have you.
Okay.
And you really must talk to her because she can tell you more about the beginning of IUP. She knows Carol Nathan, of course. They work together. I'm trying to think who else would be in IUPUI. I believe that part of the reason you don't find what research and sponsored mm-hmm. programs did in the IUPUI archives mm-hmm. is that all of the money was coming to the health schools.
Okay.
And people still associated the dean, who was me, mm-hmm. with the health schools rather than with IUPUI. Mm-hmm. But we certainly did everything in the grants area for all of the schools. I mean, law, all the rest of them. Liberal arts, mm-hmm. social work, education. As they grew, we grew along with them, and we managed their programs.
Okay. Now, getting back to the engineering position. What did you do in your year as
just
dean?
What deans do. Lord, lady. Where does one start? In the first place, I met with all of the faculty and got them relaxed. They really were very good faculty. Mm-hmm. Listened to them. Help them, quite honestly, restore their self-confidence. Mm-hmm. This man was demoralizing. Mm-hmm. He came in there and he said, anybody who doesn't have a doctorate is worthless and will not, you don't do that, particularly mm-hmm. in a school that has a major focus in technology, where a doctorate is mm-hmm. not the ultimate degree. Mm-hmm. I just got that together. Worked a great deal with a program with the U.S. Navy. It was a contract that brought a particular research unit of the Navy from the Mojave Desert in California to the canal. We worked with the city to get the land on which we could build the building to house the facility. It is now the radiological unit. And again, this all came and went. This is such terribly important at its time, means absolutely nothing now. Saw a lot of faculty grievances. Was responsible for changing to chairman of the department. The biggest thing I did, I think, was actually getting Purdue to recognize and official approval for the electrical engineering department to develop a bioengineering program, which is now pretty good. And we sweated blood to get them to allow Purdue students to take doctoral level courses in the engineering department at IUPUI. And that was ripping. Took a lot of time. So if I had to look back and say, well, what did you do? I certainly helped establish the bioengineering program. Established a good base for the next dean to come in and run the school, and Honor Yurtsevin's been wonderful. I guess you'd have to ask other people. I must have done some things right because they made an award in the Doris H. Merritt every year. Yeah, I have awards in three schools.
Wow, that's amazing.
I think it's probably unique.
So now at that point when your year was over, is that
what
when you
I
retired
do?
Or did you
the
continue?
The third time. That was at the second mm-hmm. or third time. That was the first time was I sort of left the federal mm-hmm. government and retired. Mm-hmm. Then I left the School of Medicine, that's right. Then I retired from engineering and went back to do my little office thing and help people in medicine. And then Jerry called and said, we have to establish an office of research and graduate education. Mm-hmm. Will you be the vice chancellor, acting vice chancellor, to get this started? Mm-hmm. And I said, 6 months, Jerry. He said, fine. At the end of 6 months, they didn't have a search and screen committee appointed. I said, Jerry, another 6 months. Mm-hmm. The end of the year, I stopped in his office and I said, enough is enough. 6 months, mm-hmm. out. they got a search and screening committee appointed. And in that was simply, I never tried to do anything in that year except clean up graduate education, which I did. But I never tried to do anything because I wasn't going to be there. And one thing I've learned is that it takes, it takes about 5 years to establish and get a new program running smoothly. So I signed a lot of papers, I sat at a lot of committee meetings, I developed a lot of job descriptions, I helped reorganize the way graduate programs were administered on the IUPUI campus.
And then when that was over, then...
When that was over, I said, I'm 75 years old, and it's clear that I cannot come back here part-time. It is all or nothing, and for me it's nothing. Except, of course, I still was involved in the Center for Women's Health, which I had helped establish during that period of time.
Okay.
With Rose Fife, who is marvelous, and runs it. Again, that's medicine. I never, ever could lose contact with medicine. That's what I was.
So with the Center for Women's Health, is that, what kind of center is that?
That's a national, it's a National Center for Women's Health. It started in the School of Medicine. It must be at least 10 years old now. Surely it is. Rose Fife agreed that she would set this up, and it's a huge cooperative venture. Acting as a focus for women's health programs, information, education, anything you can name regarding women's health. And they've done very, very well. She's done very well. You have to talk to her about that.
Now, just generally, in your years at IUPUI, you must have seen a lot of changes. Is there anything especially that you've seen that is just really very different, or very different for women, maybe, in their roles, or anything?
Very different for women. I don't know what percentage of the faculty now is women, but it must be 30 to 40 or even 50%. I think there were 3 women in the School of Medicine faculty when I was there. Maybe 4. I don't know. The only women you saw were the nurses. There was a period, of course, when there was a lot of agitation for women's rights, and there still are, and that went on. I never was particularly a part of that. I clearly supported women all the way and had the reputation of doing that and being a good mentor, but I could never, ever enlist myself in what we called women's lib movement. I felt they were raucous and unnecessary and weren't using the things that women do best to get things done. And so I was not part of that. I certainly saw the population of women in medical and law school change from virtually nothing to almost 50%. The biggest changes on the campus, of course, were physical and had not much to do with women, but in 1961 there was the old student union, there was the old Riley, there was the old Long Hospital, the old Ball Residence, the School of Dentistry, and nothing else. I mean, that was it. Emerson Hall, the old home, the old med science building. So the change there has been so dramatic in terms of this beautiful urban university now that people can be so proud of. I mean, there was nothing there. Where was the old law school? I guess that was there someplace, but it was, you know, it was way, it was all disconnected. And if you really want fun, go back into the architect's office's archives, and you can see the two-story outhouses. I mean, it's ridiculous. So that lot. As far as women is concerned, I know I was the first, outside of the school, perhaps of education, I know I was the first woman dean around. And obviously we have lots of women deans now. So it was just a very exciting time to see things happening. In which, if I played any role, it was simply that I did my job well, and so I didn't discourage people from saying, well, look, I'm seasoned, which is a real role, too. And what else have I seen happen with women? I still think they're probably not paid as much as the men, but I don't know that, so you can't quote mm-hmm. me on that. I would have to see figures on that. I believe that what's going to happen in the future, I hope what will happen in the future, is that there will be an easier way for women to work part-time, for those who want to work part-time and have families. I mean, everybody isn't the kind of workaholic I was. I just was happier working at, you know, there than I was at home, but most women are not. And I can't be convinced that it's good for the future of America to have mothers ignoring their children as much as I ignored mine. Fortunately, they turned out very well, but that could have been the other way around. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to have seen, I think McRoby is a wonderful choice as a university president, frankly. I worked with him and I admire him. I think he has is the best hope for the future of IU that I've seen. In my heart of hearts, I think it would have been wonderful if they could have found a woman the way Purdue has. Mm-hmm. And I just have to cheer Purdue for Dr. Cordova, mm-hmm. who has such a wonderful background and seems to be such an excellent person to lead that university. And I feel a little jealous that IU doesn't have her, which is not to detract from McRoby, because I think he's fine, but the time is coming. And women should be in positions like that. And I also believe that I'll call it the female temperament, because you know we do have different hormones. I do think we are a little bit gentler in our firmness. I mean, nobody's ever accused me of being a patsy. But I have fired people without making them so angry at me they hung me in effigy. And I think that's something women do better than men, not necessarily firing people, but I think making difficult decisions and making them more palatable. So as a generality, which is as useful as most generalities, I think it's a good thing that women are coming more to the fore in managerial positions.
Wonderful. And I thank you for your time, and I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks for giving me a lot of information.
Well, I've enjoyed meeting with you. And let me go get you.